All right, good morning again. Hope everybody's doing well this morning. We're studying more Kings, so get ready for a wild ride. Does anybody remember what we talked about last week? Tasha, what did we talk about? Rehoboam, Jeroboam, and last week we talked also about Rehoboam's grandson Asa, right? And what do we learn about Asa? Good or bad?
Bad.
He was good. He made some bad choices, though. All right, so we talked about Asa last week, and we actually talked about, now I can't even remember his name. I think Abijah was his dad. We talked about, it was Abijah and Asa, and those were the Judean kings. And Abijah was rotten. Asa was a good guy who made some bad decisions. This week, we're going to talk about Israelite kings. So the kings of Israel that were kings of the same time, during that same time period. The first guy we're going to talk about is Nadab. Nadab is Jeroboam's son. So if you remember, Jeroboam was the servant of Solomon, who, when Rehoboam became king, Jeroboam basically became a leader of a rebellion, and the 10 northern tribes split off and started the nation and remained actually under the name of Israel, and the kings under the Davidic line took the name Judah as their name. And so Nadab is a son of that man who became king of Israel, Jeroboam. Does anybody remember what Jeroboam did? Anybody remember? People say they want to participate, but when I ask questions, nobody says nothing. What did Jeroboam do?
Evil.
Thank you, Jared. Jeroboam did evil in the sight of the Lord, and his son Nadab didn't do much else other than evil. So he only reigned for 2 years, did evil in the sight of the Lord. And there's just one verse I want to read about him in 1 Kings 15. 1 Kings 15, verse 29 through 30. So we have Nadab, son of Jeroboam, ruler of the northern kingdom of Israel. And in verse 29, we read about him. It came about as soon as he was king, he struck down... Let's go up to verse 27. Then Baasha, the son of Ahijah, of the house of Issachar, conspired against Nadab. And Baasha struck him down at Gibbethon, which belonged to the Philistines, while Nadab and all Israel were laying siege to Gibbethon. So Baasha killed him in the third year of Asa, king of Judah, and reigned in his place. It came about as soon as he was king, he struck down all the household of Jeroboam. He did not leave to Jeroboam any persons alive until he had destroyed them, according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by his servant Ahijah the Shilonite. So basically all we know about Nadab is he was king, reigned for 2 years, and then he was killed by this guy. And Baasha struck him down in fulfillment of prophecy against Jeroboam. The prophecy against Jeroboam, which was, you will no longer rule Israel because you turned your back on the Lord who brought you up from the dust and made you king, and you and your children will all be killed. And that occurred. That's what happened to Jeroboam and his whole family, and Baasha carried it out. And then Baasha, he's the usurper, he usurped the kingdom. He's a son of Ahijah of Issachar. We don't know who that guy is. He's not any of the Ahijahs we've talked about who've said any prophecies. He's just some guy from Issachar. And Baasha reigned for a good long time of 24 years, but he also, as you can read up there, did what? Evil, yes. And that's going to be a recurring theme with the Israelite kings, is they did evil. They weren't good. Because what had Jeroboam done when he became king? Does anybody remember what Jeroboam did upon becoming king? He built idols. He built two idols, two golden calves, one on the north end of Israel, one on the south end. And what was his motivation for doing so? So people won't go to Jerusalem. So Jeroboam, even though God had told him, when he said, I'm going to make you king, he told him, if you serve me, I will make your kingdom great, and nobody will be able to conquer you. Jeroboam thought, well, I'm smarter than that. I know that if my people go down to Jerusalem to serve God, that they're going to turn back to Judah. And so he built himself two idols, and he didn't turn from that idolatry his whole life. And that's the same thing that basically every single king of Israel does, is they don't take down those idols. They continue to lead the children of Israel into idolatry. And that's the same thing that Baasha does. So he reigns for 24 years. And then in 1 Kings 16, verse 2 through 4, we can read basically the same words that were said to Jeroboam or said to Baasha. And we see that God doesn't feel the need to be creative in the way he condemns these kings, because these kings do not feel the need to be creative in the way they sin against God. Jeroboam created two idols and had the children of Israel serve them. He did not turn from that. God gives him a prophecy saying, I'm going to strike you down. That same prophecy is used against every king who continues to serve those idols. God just tells him the same thing. And this is what he says in 1 Kings 16, verse 2. Inasmuch as I exalted you from the dust and made you leader over my people Israel, and you have walked in the way of Jeroboam and have made my people Israel sin, provoking me to anger with their sins, behold, I'll consume Baasha and his house, and I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Anyone of Baasha who dies in the city, the dogs will eat. And anyone of his who dies in the field, the birds of the heavens will eat. And we're going to read that, I think, two more times this morning, because that's what God tells the kings of Israel when they do not stop serving the idols. The golden calves have been set up. He tells them, anyone of, insert king's name here, who dies in the city, the dogs will eat. And anyone of, insert king here, who dies in the field, the birds of the heaven will eat. Basically, if you keep serving idols, this is going to keep happening. And they don't seem to get it, which is pretty interesting. But he makes this prophecy against Baasha, and then Baasha dies. And his son Elah begins to reign. So Elah, his son, reigns for 2 years, and it says that he provoked the Lord to anger. Elah provoked the Lord to anger, and then he is overthrown. In 1 Kings 16, 9 through 12. So, just so we're clear, his father Baasha died. He wasn't overthrown. But then his son Elah became king, and Elah is going to be overthrown in fulfillment of the prophecy, just as Jeroboam's son Nadab was overthrown in fulfillment of the prophecy. So we have Elah, and 1 Kings 16, 9 through 12 says, Elah's servant Zimri, commander of half his chariots, conspired against him. Now he was at Tirzah, drinking himself drunk in the house of Arza, who was over the household of Tirzah. Then Zimri went in and struck him and put him to death in the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah, and became king in his place. It came about when he became king, as soon as he had sat on the throne, that he killed all the household of Baasha. He did not leave a single male, neither of his relatives nor of his friends. Thus Zimri destroyed all the household of Baasha, according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke against Baasha through Jehu the prophet. So once again, doesn't serve God, gets wiped out. The same way that Nadab's house was wiped out, Elah's house was wiped out. And all this is going on, if you notice, who is the king in Judah during this whole time? Every time it says somebody's the king of Judah, who is that? Asa. So Asa's king in Judah, and then we have Israel over here just cycling through kings. Not a stable nation. And this is where I think it gets a little interesting. I know it's kind of dry. This guy became king, his son became king, his son was killed over and over and over again. Well, we have Zimri, who's the commander of the chariots. So I want you to imagine like a general in the military today overthrowing the president. That's kind of the idea we're getting here. So a general overthrows the president, and then if we read down in verse 19, we read about Zimri's sin. So Zimri is a really interesting guy. He's this general commander of the chariots. He reigned for 7 days. He was only allowed to reign for 7 days until Omri, the commander of the army, came to kill him. And when Omri comes to kill Zimri, you can read about it in these verses that are up on the PowerPoint, Zimri doesn't try and fight. Zimri just goes into a house, sets it on fire, and lets it fall on him, and dies. But what's said about Zimri is interesting, because in verse 19 it says, let's start in 18. When Zimri saw that the city was taken, he went into the citadel of the king's house and burned the king's house over him with fire and died. Because of his sins which he sinned, doing evil in the sight of the Lord, walking in the way of Jeroboam, and in his sin which he did, making Israel sin. How long does it say that Zimri reigned up there? 7 days? What did it just say in verse 19. It says, walking in the way of Jeroboam and in his sin which he did, making Israel sin. That's interesting to me. This guy reigns for 7 days, and it said that he is killed because he made Israel sin. He had 7 days. He must have really messed it up. And we can see he was a commander of the chariots before them. Maybe he was in some sort of leadership position in making Israel sin before he became king. But we don't know that. All we know is he became king, reigned for 7 days, was overthrown, and it says because he did not depart from the way of Jeroboam in making Israel sin. So we get to Omri now. Omri is the commander of the army. Think of him as another general. This is a time of civil war in Israel. You know, lots of unrest, different leaders taking over the nation. But under Omri, there's stability. Unfortunately, Omri's not a nice guy either. Because we read of Omri in 1 Kings 16, verse 25. Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord, and acted more wickedly than all who were before him. Omri was not a good guy either. He was more wicked than all the other kings before him. But he brought stability. And under Omri, there wasn't civil war any longer. Instead of a general or some guy from Issachar taking over, Omri's son became king. Does anybody know who Omri's son is? Ahab. So Omri did more wickedly than all the kings before him, and then his son Ahab becomes king. He's a son of Omri. He's a pretty bad guy. We can read in verse 29. Of 1 Kings 16. Now Ahab the son of Omri became king over Israel in the 38th year of Asa king of Judah, and Ahab the son of Omri reigned over Israel and Samaria 22 years. Ahab the son of Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. So Omri, his dad, did more evil than everybody before him, and then his son, not to be outdone by daddy, did more evil than even his father had done. And Ahab is where we're really going to start looking at this, starting to our study of this king. Because all these other guys, we don't have much information on, but we need to know that what was happening in Israel. There was a lot of unrest, power was changing a lot, and it wasn't typically in a peaceful manner. And finally, under Omri and Ahab, we have some peace. And under Ahab, he reigns for 22 years, and we have a lot of information about that reign, and that's what we're going to spend the rest of our class this morning looking at. So Ahab becomes king. I want to ask you guys another question. I know you love that. What do we know about Ahab? Married Jezebel. Yeah, not a good decision, right? What else do we know about Ahab? Had to head-to-head with Elijah a lot. Is that what he said? Yeah, they butted heads a lot. Anything else? Did Ahab ever repent? Rhonda's nodding. Rhonda is nodding. We'll get into that later. All right, so Ahab did a lot of bad, but at one point, God shows him mercy because he did repent. But then he continues to do bad after that. So, but he's not a good guy. And the first thing I want to cover is just his beginnings. So it's in 1 Kings 16, 31 through 33. We already read that verse. He did more evil than all the kings before him. Let's read what he did, what the evil was that he did. Starting in verse 31 of 1 Kings 16, it came about as though it had been a trivial thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, that is, leaving the two idols, one in Dan, one in Bethel, that he married Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and went to serve Baal and worshipped him. So he erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria. Ahab also made the Asherah. Thus Ahab did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel than all the kings of Israel who were before him. All right, do we know what Baal is? Does anybody know? It's an idol, right? And Asherah is another idol. I was kind of interested to see what these idols were. Baal, it could actually refer to any number of gods of the Canaanites or the people in that region. But most of the time, it's a sun god. And different regions worshipped him in different ways. But in general, he was worshipped with prostitution and just lots of nasty stuff. And what Ahab did was built a temple for him in Samaria. And then we have the Asherah. Asherah was like a counterpart of Baal, female moon deity, and her worship included a lot of sensuality and ritual prostitution. So basically, we just have a lot of bad stuff going on in Israel, and the king of Israel is saying, hey guys, not only do I endorse this, but I'm going to build a temple for it in the capital of our nation. So that's Ahab's start. That's the first thing he does. Marries Jezebel, builds a temple for Baal. Then we enters Elijah. Elijah and Ahab did not get along. They did not like each other. Ahab says this to Elijah, is that you, troubler of Israel? So Elijah declares a drought in 1 Kings 17:1. And then he runs away, and he's in hiding. And during this time, Jezebel does a lot of bad things, and Ahab does a lot of bad things. So in 1 Kings 18:3 through 4, we read about the way Jezebel responded to this drought. 1 Kings 18:3 through 4. Ahab called Obadiah, who was over the household. So Obadiah is a servant of Ahab. Now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly, for when Jezebel destroyed the prophets of the Lord, Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50s in a cave and provided them with bread and water. So while Elijah declared this drought, and the drought would last for 3 years, I believe, Jezebel goes out to kill all the prophets of the Lord. And Obadiah, who's over her household, is working against her. He hides 100 of the prophets so she can't kill them. And we read about him doing this, him proclaiming to Elijah that he did this in verse 13. And Ahab, for his part during this, searched every nation for Elijah. That's in chapter 18, verse 10. As the Lord your God lives, there is no nation or kingdom where my master Ahab has not sent to search for you, Elijah. And when they said, he is not here, he made the kingdom or nation swear that they could not find you. So during this time, Elijah's in hiding. Ahab and Jezebel are just going nuts. They're doing all they can to get Elijah and to destroy anybody who speaks for the Lord. And then this conversation with Obadiah happens in chapter 18, because what we're reading here is a conversation between Obadiah, a faithful man who was over Ahab's house, and Elijah, the prophet of the Lord. And Elijah's telling Obadiah, go tell your master to come meet me here. And Obadiah's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I know as soon as I leave to go tell my master, King Ahab, to come meet you, that the Lord is going to take you away, and then he's going to kill me. So Obadiah knew that the Lord had been protecting Elijah, and knew that as soon, in his mind, as soon as he left Elijah, the Lord was going to sweep him up. And if he told Ahab, I saw Elijah, let's go get him, Ahab was going to kill him, because God was going to protect Elijah, and Obadiah didn't feel like he was going to get that same protection. So Elijah comforts him and says, no, I'm going to stay here. He meets up with Ahab, and that's when Ahab says, is this you, you troubler of Israel? Ahab's an interesting guy. Because do you think Ahab knows what he's doing wrong? He has to know, right, that he's built a house for Baal, that he's instituted sensuality and ritual prostitution in the nation of Israel, that he's done all these bad things, and he has to know the history of the nation, that every time a king doesn't turn to the Lord, they get wiped out. But he might be a little cocky because his dad didn't turn back to the Lord. His dad was the most evil one, and his dad didn't get wiped out. So maybe he's thinking, I'm fine. I don't know what he's thinking. All he's thinking is, this isn't my problem. Elijah's troubling Israel. I need to be able to do what I want to do, what makes me feel good. And so Elijah then says, let's have a competition between your prophets and myself and see who's God, Baal or Jehovah. Something Elijah says here is interesting. 1 Kings 18:22, Elijah says, I alone am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Who did Elijah talk to get to see Ahab? Who was he talking to? We just talked about him. Obadiah. Was Obadiah a faithful man? Yeah, he was righteous. But maybe he wasn't a prophet. So maybe that's why Elijah says, I alone am the only prophet left, right? But what did Obadiah tell Elijah? In verse 13 of chapter 18. He hit 100 prophets. Obadiah hit 100 prophets of the Lord. They were still alive. And he told Elijah this. Elijah then goes on to say, I alone am left. I'm just saying this to get an insight into Elijah's mindset. Elijah was alone. Elijah wasn't hiding in a cave with 49 other prophets where he knew that he had support. Elijah was in the wilderness being fed by ravens. Then he was in the house of a foreign woman and her son. And then her son died and he revives him. And he's going through this trial all alone with no support, just him and God. And this is how he's feeling. He says, I alone am left. And then we know what happens. God is proved right. Prophets of Baal are proved false. Elijah calls down fire from the heavens, and the altar is completely destroyed that he has set up as a sacrifice to the Lord. Unfortunately, when this happens, Jezebel is not convinced. Jezebel, for her part, says in 1 Kings 19:2, after Elijah has proven that Jehovah is God and killed all the prophets of Baal, Jezebel says in 1 Kings 19:2, then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, so may the gods do to me and even more if I do not make your life as the life of one of the prophets by tomorrow about this time. She doesn't care. She's there to do whatever sensual thing she wants, to be in power, and to serve whatever it is that she wants to serve in her heart. She's not concerned with what the truth is, that fire from heaven fell down and consumed an entire altar, and that there were witnesses, all of Israel witnessed it. All she's concerned about is serving herself. So then we go on. Elijah flees. And we're not going to spend much more time on that. But what we're going to talk about next is Ahab's war with Syria. So Elijah flees from Jezebel, and we know that he goes to a cave, talks to God, and then Ahab continues to be king. And Ahab, in 1 Kings 20, goes to war with Syria. I like this part, 1 Kings 20, verse 1 through 11, because it gives us more insights into Ahab. I would say that Ahab is a coward in how he deals with every situation we see him dealing with. It's interesting because his dad was the commander of an army, so we know his dad couldn't have been a coward, but it seems like Ahab really was just not able to stand up for himself and not able to really be confident. He didn't feel good about like making good decisions and being a confident leader. He felt good about basically letting Jezebel make all the calls and acting cowardly towards all the other nations. So if we see this, we can see this in 1 Kings 20, when a foreign king has set up a siege of Ahab's nation, and they're in tents outside his nation, and this foreign king, the king of Syria, sends a messenger, and he says in chapter 20, verse 3, to Ahab, your silver and your gold are mine. Your most beautiful wives and children are also mine. So he's saying, I'm going to take all your money, I'm going to take your wives, and I'm going to take your children. They're all mine now. Seems like he's trying to like incite Ahab. And Ahab responds by saying, it is according to your word, my lord, O king. I am yours and all that I have. Somebody tells you, everything you have is mine. Your spouse, your kids, they're mine. I'm going to take them. What do you say? If you're Ahab, you say, please, take it. Take everything. He's a coward. But then, verse 5, then the messengers returned and said, thus says Ben-Hadad, that's the king of Syria, surely I sent you saying, you shall give me your silver and your gold and your wives and your children. But about this time tomorrow, I will send my servants to you, and they will search your house and the houses of your servants. And whatever is desirable in your eyes, they will take in their hand and carry away. So the king of Syria is saying, okay, that didn't work out the way I wanted. I really wanted to make him mad and make him incite him. So he says, okay, maybe he doesn't care about his wives, his gold, his silver, and his children. So he says, whatever you like, whatever is desirable in your eyes, that's the thing I'm going to take. And so Ahab then, that works for some reason. And down in verse 7, it says, "Then the king of Israel called the elders of the land and said, 'Please observe and see how this man is looking for trouble.'" And that's exactly what he was doing, right? First he says, "I'm going to take your wives." And Ahab's like, "Okay, whatever." And then he's like, "I'm going to take whatever you like, whatever it is that is of value to you." And then Ahab's like, "Okay, maybe I need to talk to the elders. This is getting pretty serious." So Ahab talks to the elders and says that. And then all the elders said, and the people say, "Don't consent to this, Ahab." Like, what else are they going to say? "Don't consent to them taking everything of ours." So then Ahab gets kind of snarky. I like what he says, because he says down there, well, he says, "I'll do the first thing, but I'm not going to do the second thing." And then Ben-Hadad says, "I'm going to kill you." And Ahab says, "Let not him who puts on his armor boast like the one who takes it off." Basically, you're bragging now, but the battle hasn't happened. After the battle, that's when you can brag. After you've defeated me, then you can boast. But now, you can't. You have nothing to brag about. And I like that. I think that's a cool thing that Ahab says. That's part of Ahab that I like, is that he said that. Because that's, I don't know, that to me is manly. That is, he's fighting for his nation now. I don't know what he was thinking before. He was thinking, "I don't know what to do." He's acting cowardly. But he kind of gets it together, and they go to war. They go to war, and God defeats Aram. God defeats Syria. That's Aram. And God defeats them first in the mountains. We read about that in verses 19 through 22. And then in verse 23, Syria says, "Oh, they must have a mountain god who's very powerful in the mountains. So next time we're going to attack them in the valleys." And then God says to Ahab, "They think that I'm only strong in the mountains, so go out to the valley and I'll show you how I'm going to defeat them in the valley." And then down in verse 28, they defeat them in the valley. But in 1 Kings 20, 38 through 43, we see something else about Ahab. But first, go up to verse 31. 1 Kings 20, 31. So Syria is completely defeated. And in verse 31, it says, "Ben-Hadad's servant said to him," behold now, that's the king of Syria, "behold now, we have heard that the kings of the house of Israel are merciful kings," or weak kings. Please, not that mercy is weakness, but I feel like that's what they're saying about Ahab. "We heard that Ahab's not going to kill us," basically. Because then they say, "Please let us put sackcloth on our loins and ropes on our heads and go out to the king of Israel. Perhaps he will save your life." So they girded sackcloth on their loins and put rope on their heads and came to the king of Israel and said to him, "Your servant, Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, says, 'Please let me live.'" And he said, "Is he still alive? He is my brother." So Ahab says of the king of Syria, "Is he still alive? He's my brother." After God had just delivered Syria into his hands twice, and after Ben-Hadad had said all these things that he's going to do to Ahab and his family, Ahab says, "He's my brother." And he lets him live. And God doesn't like this, because God was trying to prove a point. And down in verse 38 through 43, we find out what a prophet does. A prophet disguised himself with a bandage over his eyes. As the king passed by, he cried to the king and said, "Your servant went out into the midst of battle, and behold, a man turned aside and brought a man to me and said, 'Guard this man. If for any reason he is missing, then your life shall be for his life, or else you shall pay a talent of silver.' Well, your servant was busy here, and there he was gone." And the king of Israel, "Well, your servant was busy here and there, he was gone." So the man he had been put in charge of was gone. He disappeared. He lost the guy he's supposed to keep track of. And the king of Israel said to him, "So shall your judgment be. You yourself have decided it. You were supposed to take care of this person, and it was his life for yours, and you didn't. So that's the judgment. You decided it. You did it." And the prophet says to him, "Thus says the Lord, because you have let go out of your hand the man whom I had devoted to destruction, therefore your life shall go for his life and your people for his people." So the king of Israel went away sullen and vexed and came to Samaria. God wasn't just saving Israel for the sake of saving Israel. And if Ahab had realized how he was living, how he was leading, he might have thought, "Why is God on my side?" But he didn't consider that. Instead, he was just like, "Oh, God's with me, finally, and now I can defeat Syria and do whatever I want." But the whole purpose for God being with Ahab was not preservation of Israel. We saw this last week when God was with an evil Judean king. And God was with Ahab so that he could do God's work, which it was to defeat the Syrians, who were an evil nation. God was trying to take out some bad guys, and he was using Israel to do that. And Ahab, instead, let them go free. And so God said, okay, then I'm going to take your life instead of his, because you did not follow through with what you were supposed to do. And the chapter ends with Ahab sullen and vexed, which seems to be the way Ahab was a lot. Sullen and vexed. And I don't really like Ahab. I don't know how you guys feel. Like, I don't like all the bad things he did. That's evil. We can't say that's okay. But what's interesting in studying Ahab is the other thing I don't like about him is who he was as a human being. Like, he wasn't a good guy. He wasn't a good leader. He wasn't nice. He didn't have any redeeming qualities. He's just kind of not a guy you want to hang out with. So we have next, Ahab is coveting Naboth's vineyard. I think we all are familiar with this story. But I want to skip that one to get to Ahab and Jehoshaphat. Because next week we're going to talk, or 2 weeks, we're going to talk about Jehoshaphat. He's the king of Judah. At the same time, Ahab is king of Israel. And so 3 years after Ahab spares the life of the king of Syria, Syria comes back against him. And Ahab asks the king of Judah to help him. Does anybody know why the king of Judah would help the king of Israel? Because the king of Judah was married to Ahab's daughter. So Jehoshaphat is the king of Judah at this time. And we know from Chronicles, Jehoshaphat was a really good guy. He might be like one of my favorite kings of Judah. He's solid on the word of God. He sent out priests and scribes all over the nation to teach Judah about God. And his nation was powerful, and he was a good leader. And he was friends with Ahab. So we're going to learn about what God thought about that on Jehoshaphat's side in 2 weeks. But what we're going to talk about today is Ahab calls Jehoshaphat down, and this is where Ahab dies. Because Jehoshaphat comes to help Ahab fight the kings of Syria. And this is a conversation they have as soon as Jehoshaphat arrives in Samaria. 1 Kings 22, 3 through 9, it says, "Now the king of Israel, that is Ahab, said to his servants, 'Do you know that Ramoth Gilead belongs to us, and we are still doing nothing to take it out of the hand of the king of Aram? So do you know that this city over here belongs to us, and we're not doing anything about it? We're letting Syria hold it.' And he said to Jehoshaphat, 'Will you go with me to battle against Ramoth Gilead?' And Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, 'I am as you are, my people as your people, my horses as your horses.' Moreover, Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, 'Please inquire first for the word of the Lord.' So then Ahab gets all these prophets together, and they all say really nice things. But then down in verse 7, Jehoshaphat says, 'Is there not yet a prophet of the Lord here that we may inquire of him?' So Jehoshaphat, this faithful guy, he's being so mild-mannered here. Sounds like Ahab has gotten all these prophets who don't serve Jehovah, and then Jehoshaphat's like, well, don't you have one that served God? What does he say? And then Ahab says, 'There is yet one man by whom we may inquire of the Lord, but I hate him, because he does not prophesy good concerning me, but evil. He is Micah, son of Imlah.' But Jehoshaphat said, 'Let not the king say so.' So they call Micah, and Micah says, basically, first Micah says down in verse 15, 'You're going to succeed, you're going to do great.' And then Ahab says, 'How many times must I adjure you to speak to me nothing but the truth in the name of the Lord?' Basically, I know you're lying to me, Micah, because you never say anything good about me." And then Micah says something interesting. We're going to read that, and then we're going to close class. He says in verse 19, "Therefore hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, and all the hosts of heaven standing by him, on his right and on his left. The Lord said, 'Who will entice Ahab to go up and fall at Ramoth Gilead?' And one said this, while another said that. Then a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord and said, 'I will entice him.' The Lord said to him, how? And he said, I will go out and be a deceiving spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. Then he said, you are to entice him and also prevail. Go and do so. Now therefore, behold, the Lord has put a deceiving spirit in the mouth of all these your prophets, and the Lord has proclaimed disaster against you. So we have this picture of God sending out this deceiving spirit. And that's kind of hard to comprehend how God could do that. And that's why I want to talk about it really quickly before we close. I see this situation the same as a situation in Job, where the devil comes to God and says, can I have your prophet Job? And God says, go and see what happens. Or the situation in Luke where Christ tells Peter, Satan has requested to sift you like wheat, but when you come around, strengthen the brothers. This is the same situation. God's saying, okay, deceiving spirit, you can go. Go to King Ahab. But then God gives him full disclosure that he did that. God gives him another prophet that says, hey, you're being deceived. All these prophets, they have a demon in them telling them to tell you lies. Just so you know, it's not real. All the prophecies are fake. And what do you think Ahab does? He listens to the demon, even though he was told it was a demon. And that's what costs him his life. And that's Ahab. That's the end of our class today. I know we just covered like a lot of kings and it was pretty fast, but Israel's kings are kind of just, they're not fun to study. I get no joy from looking at them because they're not good people. They made a lot of bad decisions, so don't be like them. Class dismissed.